Ravi wants automotive industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Iran has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce 6 different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, 4WD trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Iran, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the international airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that.
And, the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.
The thousands of people attending this rally today are proof that all Palestinian resistance factions are united against the Israeli enemy. We assert today during this victory and unity rally that armed resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine and regain our rights.
The popularity of Islamic Jihad movement continues to gain momentum among Palestinians due to its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. During the 3 days of intense fighting, the Islamic Jihad rockets shattered Israel's so-called invincibility myth.
Al-Quds Brigade is sending a very strong message today to the Israeli enemy regarding the growing might of the Palestinian resistance. The enemy thought that assassinating Al-Quds Brigade commanders will weaken the Islamic Jihad, but that did not happen. Al-Quds Brigade are stronger today than ever and will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
During the 3 days of fighting, the Islamic Jihad military wing fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories. Observers say that the Islamic Jihad fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime, forcing Tel Aviv to demand a ceasefire.
The strength of the Palestinian resistance has forced the Israeli enemy to ask for a truce. The Palestinian resistance is here to protect the Palestinian people and to liberate our land. The Al-Quds brigades have managed to fire hundreds of rockets at the enemy and forced it to evacuate their towns and run for cover.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008.
Experts believe that in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has paid what could be his last visit to Ukraine as Premier. Meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, on Wednesday, Boris was hailed for his relentless support for Ukraine's war effort. He was even given a medal for his services. In the midst of ceremonies and handshakes, Johnson, however, reminded his fellow countrymen that there will be more economic hardships to come.
We also know that if we're paying in our energy bills for the evils of Vladimir Putin, the people of Ukraine are paying in their blood. And that's why we know we must stay the course.
Following the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine, Britain has pushed a hardline policy of arming the Ukrainians and sanctioning Russia. The result has been catastrophic on the British economy, further exacerbating a cost of living crisis and raising fuel prices to eye-watering levels.
Boris Johnson is completely out of touch with reality. This millionaire prime minister is telling the British people that they're going to have to continue to tighten the belts. He's presided over probably the worst cost of living crisis in living memory, which has been precipitated in large measure by Boris Johnson and his government's support for a war in Ukraine, which could have quite easily been avoided. Energy bills have already doubled, or certainly gone up by well over 50%. We're being told by the energy regulator that the cap on energy bills is going to be increased still further. Already we have food banks in every town and city in this country because people can't afford to eat. Now we're going to, it looks like, have to set up in the voluntary sector kind of warm banks, I suppose, where people will be looking to go to community centres to keep warm. This is an absolute outrage.
Despite the hardships, Johnson's comments have made it perfectly clear that costs will continue to rise even after he leaves Downing Street, and British taxpayers are going to have to pay the price.
Boris may be enjoying the reputation he's built up for himself inside Ukraine, a country now left devastated by the war. However, his popularity at home may take another dive as the winter months rapidly approach and families will inevitably struggle to heat their homes and feed their loved ones this Christmas. Robert Carter, London.
Iran and Tanzania have vowed to draw a roadmap for developing bilateral relations in various dimensions. One of them is economy and trade. In this regard, Tanzania's business hub, Dar es Salaam, hosted a joint meeting of economic and trade activists from the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, addressed the forum, saying the development of economic relations with African countries, especially Tanzania, is one of the foreign policy priorities of Iran.
The African continent is one of the major economic diplomacy priorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Along this line, Tanzania, as one of the most important countries in the continent, has always had this special status in the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
He also expressed that Iran is prepared to help Tanzania achieve its goals of development and industrialization. He added that both sides are determined to prioritize economic diplomacy. Over 20 Iranian public and private sector companies took part in the forum to show Tehran's serious will for business cooperation with Tanzania.
Africa is a very huge market, and many world powers come to Africa for discovering new opportunities. So I'm here with Iranian delegates to explore the east of Africa, especially Tanzania, to find out the opportunities, especially in telecommunication business, as our company involved in telecom sector.
Business cooperation between Iran and Tanzania is a bilateral opportunity for the two sides. In addition, Africa is the perfect market for Iranian goods like petrochemicals and the food industry products.
Tanzanian economic activists expressed their excitement about the expanding economic ties, saying they had been eagerly waiting for the joint business forum to kick off.
So there is a huge opportunity. Also, having this forum in Tanzania, we have been looking for it for several times. We have been asking for it because we know for all the challenges that we have been observing, this kind of forum can build up that bridge, can bridge up a gap of closing those challenges. So for us, it's a big marriage.
It is a fruitful opportunity for both countries, Iran and Tanzania, to do a cooperation in business, especially in trade, so as we can do exportation and importation of different commodities from two countries. And it is politically stable. We invite more Iranians and other investors to come invest in Tanzania. We have so much opportunity, so guys, you can maximize profit, but also make Iran better and Tanzania better.
Taking Africa's economic potential into account, the Islamic Republic opted to expand relations with African countries. Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian's tour can be the launchpad for the Iranian government's long-term plans to expand trade with Africa.
Tehran has attached considerable significance to Africa as it looks to expand its ties with countries beyond West Asia. And Amir Abdollahian's African tour highlights the view that the world is not limited to the West. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. At 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine, Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not forget the supply chain problems which began with the coronavirus pandemic, nor the European sovereign debt crisis.
Despite the increase in gloom, last month the European Central Bank decided to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. That makes borrowing even more costly for businesses and individuals and could spark mass layoffs, bankruptcies, and home foreclosures. The U.S. has hiked interest rates faster than in Europe, while indicating that more rate increases will arrive soon. Since the Great Recession began, Western central banks have aligned their policies, though they do not move in an exact lockstep. The cost of living crisis is expected to significantly worsen this winter. However, many say a negative outlook for the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc is more accurately described in years and not just seasons.
Inflation is something which could penalize the average person for 1, 2, or maybe even 3 years. So we are witnessing how the average French household is getting much, much poorer. Senior citizens are especially being hurt, and this will have major political consequences in France.
Analysts say a possible solution to Europe's energy crisis is to implement the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. However, both Washington and Tel Aviv continue to hinder Europe's ability to protect its own economic interests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's wait-and-see stance on Israeli regime's escalated attacks against several prominent Palestinian organizations puts their staff at risk of arbitrary detention and torture. Those groups and observers warn. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. gives green light to Israeli regime's attacks on human rights groups. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's wait-and-see stance on the Zionist regime's escalated attacks against several prominent Palestinian organizations puts their staff at risk of arbitrary detention and torture, those groups and observers warn. The Zionist regime raided 7 organizations in Ramallah area of occupied West Bank last week, shortly after an Israeli regime military commander rejected an appeal lodged by some of the organizations challenging an order designating them as terrorist groups late last year. Tel Aviv claims that the organizations are front groups for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party with an armed resistance wing that is outlawed by the fake regime of Israel, the United States regime, and the EU. All 7 organizations, including Al-Damir Al-Haq, the Bisson Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International Palestine, the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Health Work Committees, were sealed shut and issued orders declaring their groups unlawful. The Zionist regime troops confiscated equipment and, in the case of some of the groups, files from their raided and sealed offices. Defense for Children International Palestine and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees say the Israeli regime troops seized files containing sensitive information regarding child clients and women receiving psychological support.
The targeted groups have been working in Palestine for decades and receive international funding to support their work. That work includes providing legal representation to Palestinians held without charge or trial by the Zionist regime, international human rights advocacy, providing jobs and social services to Palestinian women and farmers, providing health care to rural communities, promoting women's and workers' rights, and representing children who are tried in the Zionist regime military courts. Put more simply, the organizations are either dedicated to challenging Israeli regime impunity or strengthening Palestinian steadfastness and resiliency under the extreme pressures of perpetual military dictatorship. Because they are a point of friction for the occupation, they have been subjected to harassment and smear campaigns by the Zionist regime and its proxies for years, including raids and the arrest and detention of their staff, in a bid to hamper their work and dry up their international funding. Khaled Qusmar, the Director of Defense for Children International Palestine, said during a webinar hosted by Democracy for the Arab World Now, a U.S.-based organization founded by the murdered writer Jamal Khashoggi recently, "In the past, they used to work in order to silence us, and now they're working in order to eliminate us, eliminate our work, and even the organization." Qusmar was summoned by the Shin Bet, the Zionist regime's secret police, for an interview recently following the raids. The officer made clear that he knew detailed information about Qusmar's family members in order to intimidate him. "They haven't faced ever any real accountability," Shaban Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, said of the Zionist regime during the same webinar. "They failed in the last 15 years to silence us, to push us back, to get us down and dry our resources," he said, leaving the Zionist regime with the final tactic to declare them as terrorist organization. "They are not ready to accept this. They challenge them to prove what they say." Like Qusmar, someone claiming to be an agent with the Shin Bet, the Zionist regime's secret police called Jabarin recently and summoned him to a nearby military base. Jabarin, who said that phone call was of a threatening nature, refused to comply. He added, "If they have a problem with Shawan Jabarin, the only thing I ask for is due process and a fair trial. Let them take me today," he said, pledging to continue his organization's human rights work despite the personal threats. "If there is one person who should be behind bars," Jabarin said, "it's Mr. Gantz and his commanders, those who are responsible for committing war crimes in the occupied territory, including Gaza, East Al-Quds, and the West Bank." Jabarin was referring to Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime's war minister, who issued the terror designations against Al-Haq and other groups. Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime's war minister, is a person of interest in the International Criminal Court's investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza, which was opened last year. The United States and the Israeli regime, as well as many of Tel Aviv's European allies, some of whom fund the organizations targeted by Gantz, opposed the ICC's investigation in Palestine. Three of the targeted groups, including Al-Haq Ad-Damir and Defense for Children International Palestine, have provided evidence for the ICC investigation. During his visit to Al-Quds last month, Joe Biden pledged to shield the Zionist regime from accountability, including at the UN and International Criminal Court. Earlier this week, The Guardian reported that a classified CIA report shows the agency was unable to find any evidence to support the Zionist regime's decision to designate the Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations. A U.S. agency received intelligence from the Israeli regime regarding the designations, but like multiple European countries, did not find any evidence to support the claim, The Guardian reported, citing two sources familiar with the study. Despite not buying the Zionist regime's claims, Washington has so far refused to publicly challenge the Israeli regime over designations and other measures taken against the Palestinian groups. The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said this week that we continue to seek additional information from our Israeli partners. He added that we remain concerned about the impacts of the closure of the offices of these Palestinian NGOs in and around Ramallah, and we've made clear to our Israeli and to our Palestinian counterparts that independent civil society organizations in the West Bank must be able to continue their important work, he said. But when asked why the U.S. wouldn't forthrightly condemn the Israeli regime's actions, Price said, the Israelis have told us that they have information in their possession that would justify taking action against the groups. Price was admitting that the United States is giving the Israeli regime indefinite time to retroactively justify the designations, potentially putting the organization's staff and wider networks at risk of arbitrary detention and torture. I found the most troubling element of the U.S. response to what happened last week to be the statement about waiting for more evidence, Laura Friedman of the Foundation for Middle East Peace said during the Dawn webinar, adding, because waiting for more evidence is not a passive statement, it is an active green light and encouragement for Israel to crack down further on these groups in order to try to manufacture more circumstantial evidence. Friedman pointed to the discredited secret dossier on the groups that was given by the Zionist regime to European diplomats in May 2021 and supposedly contained information that justified the terror organizations. Friedman said that dossier consisted virtually entirely of evidence in the form of statements made by Palestinians under interrogation after they had been arrested by Israelis for similar charges. This is coercive interrogation on top of an already coercive military court system that leaves Palestinians with no due process. In another recent event, Friedman noted that the Zionist regime operates a plea bargain factory in its military courts. Joanna Rishmavi, a Spanish aid worker in her 60s, took a plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the health work committees, which was declared illegal by the fake regime of Israel in early 2020. The health work committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against it, arresting its director, Sata Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Friedman told the Dawn webinar, what Rishmavi pled guilty to effectively was unknowingly providing aid to an organization that Israel defines as a terrorist group. The Zionist regime held up Rishmavi's plea agreement made in a highly coercive context in which Rishmavi had no hope of actual justice as proof against the targeted organizations. 24 independent UN experts condemned the Zionist regime's escalating attacks on the Palestinian groups and urged the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, which includes the U.S., to protect the Palestinian organizations and staff whose offices were raided and closed. The experts also called on the EU and its member states in particular to use their leverage to stop these aggressive attacks. So far, European diplomats have only managed to muster up photo ops and toothless statements of concern, even though the European Union is implicated in the designations. Even Zionist groups such as Americans for Peace Now, J Street, and the New Israel Fund are urging Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, to address Israel's persecution of Palestinian civil society, challenging the complicity of the U.S. regime, which subsidizes the Zionist regime's military occupation and provides Tel Aviv with missiles used to bomb residential towers in Gaza, and shields the Zionist regime from accountability through its veto at the UN Security Council, remains key. It would only take one phone call from Secretary Blinken, Al-Haq's Susan Power said, adding, just one phone call.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States has been accused of a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East or West Asia. It was reported that dozens of social media accounts, which have been closed, as it's been reported at this point, operated for years in an attempt to influence people in the Middle East or West Asia and Asia. A new study believes the U.S. is behind it. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask why the U.S. deemed it so important to alter or to influence the opinions and thoughts of people in this region in particular, and what was their goal behind this. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And also editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me ask you a simple question here from you, Arya Barzari. When you come to understanding what this title means of what the U.S. has been accused, can you break it down for us? Because maybe it could be a bit confusing to some. The accusation, a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East and in part Asia, which includes Russia and China.
Sure. Actually, it's nothing new when you look at it from a historical perspective. I mean, the U.S. has been always involved in covert plans and missions, either by coups against various countries, you know, committing coups, inciting coups, or via media such as the Radio Free Europe during the Cold War, or even after that. What is new in this instance is the use or the abuse of social media. And what is even more interesting is that giant social media companies such as Twitter and Facebook decided to speak up and speak against the U.S. and U.K. government and played the role of whistleblowers. While for years we used to hear scandals that were Twitter and Facebook managers were involved in it, such as Cambridge Analytica and also various scandalous programs that were accusing Twitter and Facebook companies of trying to manipulate information.
What do you think they decided to speak up now? I mean, this thing was in operation for 5 years, and I can almost bet that it's still going on in one form or another, and even prior to 2012, because it cites the time period of 2012 to 5 years from that point on. So why speak now? Why would they target the U.S. in a sense now?
Well, at this point, we cannot say for sure. We can only speculate that they had enough of the government suppression, and they decided to fight back a little bit. And also, they were hugely harmed by the the leaks and reports about how they abused people's trust on them and how they used the information that was supposed to be private and sold it to third parties. So I think they are trying to buy some legitimacy for themselves and try to recover some of the damage that was done previously to them and show to the outside world, show to the users that we are not that corrupt and we are reliable and trustworthy social media companies and we are independent, so to speak, from governments of U.S. and UK. But this is only, I suppose, is the tip of iceberg that these two companies decided to reveal. And sure, the rest of it will stay hidden for years.
Well, I mean, Kevin Barrett, when you take a look at what was done, which I'd like for you to really expand on it for us, from what we understand, there were memes, petitions, fake news, AI-altered profile photos, propaganda, hashtags, and all sorts of things that had to be superficially made up, and that's what the U.S. has been accused of. Tell us the expanding role that the U.S. has been accused of in this particular instance, which focused on influencing people in the Middle East or West Asia, and not to mention Russia and China also.
Well, yeah, the U.S. has worked through these social media companies and through the internet, which was created in the U.S. by DARPA. Let's remember that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, actually came up with the internet, and it was originally designed as a way to avoid any kind of blockage or breakdown in the event of nuclear war. So it was a command and control and communication system, 3 C's, that was meant to survive nuclear war and be used by the American military intelligence community. That's what the internet originally was. And so they founded it, they got the infrastructure and built the infrastructure to their advantage, and they've been in control of it disproportionately, at least ever since. Now, it's a little bit like the MKUltra program and LSD. And you may recall that the CIA developed LSD and along with a long list of other drugs that it was using to try to brainwash people. And then the hippies got hold of it, and pretty soon they were sort of deprogramming people from the CIA mentality. So here, the internet, of course, has become a tool that anybody can use to a certain extent. But the people who built that infrastructure are still in a position to use it more powerfully than others. And so I guess these revelations, which I haven't really had a chance to investigate carefully, would indicate that what's come out is stuff that we kind of already very much suspected, which is that the social media companies are very much part of the U.S. military intelligence community. Google is widely known to be essentially a branch of the CIA. Google Alphabet has been involved in some of the ugliest CIA criminal black ops, including biological weapons in Tbilisi, Georgia, smuggling the chemical weapons into Syria for use in false flags blamed falsely on Bashar al-Assad, and all sorts of things. So Google is the CIA. Facebook is the CIA plus Israel. Mark Zuckerberg is a Zionist who consults with Bibi Netanyahu. And so what these people do is that they use these outfits, the social media, to spin reality in the direction that their leadership wants them to. And sure. They've been doing this to the entire planet. They're doing it to the West, and they're doing it to the Middle East and the Islamic world.
Well, they have done it to West Asia or Middle East, as it's called, to the extent where 40% of their focus was the area of the Middle East or West Asia, and in particular, Iran was their focus. So, Mr. Mohammadi, why do you think the U.S. has such a keen interest in trying to influence and shape thoughts and stances towards Iran through social media? Why this intensity behind that?
Well, it's not a secret that the U.S. Governments, since at least Ronald Reagan, were trying to topple the Iranian system, the Iranian, and also they were working against the Iranian revolution. So what they are doing is exactly trying to brainwash people, which they are not and will not be successful in that. But they might be successful in creating small echo chambers where people who are pro-West and anti-government in Iran or China or Russia might become under the illusion that the majority of people think like them. And the social media is very capable of doing that. And it is addictive. You know, when thousands of fake accounts like your tweet or your Instagram post and give you this wrong impression that, you know, being against, working against your country is a good thing and it's a noble thing according to the Western standards, then you people, which are very small percentage of the population, might be brainwashed into doing more vulgar things. And they are, I think that they are banking on that. They are, I'm sure, more wise than, you know, to think that they are capable of toppling the government or the system in Iran, Russia, or China by thousands or even millions of fake accounts. The time that such techniques could work, for example, during the Arab uprising, is long past, and people in Middle East, China, and Russia are wiser than that, and they don't fooled twice by the same tricksters.
Okay, we're going to get to some of the things that are fake and not when it comes to Iran, and Kevin Barrett, when it comes to Russia, it actually was cited as being one of the most active campaigns in which the Russian-speaking internet users in Central Asia were targeted, and they focused on criticizing Russia over the civilian deaths, according to the way they saw it, and other atrocities when it came to the Ukraine conflict. Isn't that a way for the U.S. and these fake accounts and what have you, wanting to convince people who may doubt what is going on in the Ukraine conflict to accuse Russia rather than, in a sense, then overshadowing what Ukraine is actually doing, because Ukraine also is responsible for some of the deaths. And in the bigger picture, to convince that target that this military operation that Russia is conducting is not a good thing.
The Western mind control machine has actually done pretty well in this war on Russia through Ukraine, which is what it is. This is a Western war of aggression on Russia. But the global consciousness of that is pretty mixed, because the Western oligarchs own a disproportionate share of the global media. So they are using all sorts of means, including the creation and maintenance of huge numbers of fake social media accounts, spam bots, and so on, to try to make people think that essentially the whole world sides with them against Russia, which of course isn't true. The world largely has sided with Russia. The vast majority of the world has refused to go along with the sanctions. And this propaganda blaming Russia for atrocities in Ukraine is actually quite shameful, because the way the U.S. has fought its wars has been to make no effort whatsoever to spare civilian populations, but on the contrary, to deliberately target civilian populations. When the U.S. went into the former Yugoslavia, and then when it went into Iraq, and of course its actions elsewhere in Afghanistan and so on, always involve attacking civilian infrastructure, making life miserable for civilians. They killed perhaps 500,000-plus Iraqi children, as Madeleine Albright admitted, during the 1990s, due to the destruction of Iraqi infrastructure, leading the children to be drinking polluted water and so on. So the Americans deliberately target civilians.
Well, let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. Since you're mentioning Iraq, isn't that one of the things that the U.S. has realized its mistake, in a sense? And that is why West Asia or the Middle East is focused, because many here in this region doubt very highly the intentions that the U.S. has overall when it comes to the way that it exercises its foreign policy, given the fact that they have firsthand accounts of what happened in Iraq.
Well, yeah, the U.S. is behind the eight ball in propagandizing West Asia. And so it is, of course, trying to claim that Russia is committing all these terrible human rights violations in Ukraine, when the reality of the situation is that if Russia had chosen to wage its war on Ukraine the way the U.S. waged its war on Iraq, you would have huge numbers of Ukrainian casualties. They would have leveled much of Kiev, which Russia could do any moment that it wants. But Russia is taking this very slow, methodical approach, minimizing its own casualties and minimizing Ukrainian civilian casualties. And in the areas they're fighting, most of the people identify as Russian and speak Russian and are on the side of the Russians. So it's obvious why they're doing that. But that's the truth. And unfortunately, the media, and including social media, as we're seeing, is dominated by these Anglo-Zionist oligarchs who basically lie about everything. You know, Putin may not always tell the truth, but he usually does. Sure. And when he said that the West is the empire of lies, that was the truth.
Well, I was going to ask you now, Mr. Mahamadi, as I alluded to before, some of the fake news that has been propagated by the U.S. as a whole, and, of course, through probably some of these accounts that for the period of 5 years targeted Iran. And I'd like to ask you about those and see what you think, such as the lie that the U.S. has spread about Iran being a leading state sponsor of terrorism. We could counter that in a sense, and I'd like to get your reaction of how the truth on that is that the war on terror was conducted against groups like Al-Qaeda, Daesh, or Al-Shabaab, none of which are backed by Iran. So that's one of the falsities that the U.S. has premised when it comes to spreading the lie of the Iran being a leading state sponsor of terrorism. Do you agree with that? And what other instances of fake news on Iran do you think is being spread online, even to this day perhaps, by the U.S. through online fake accounts?
I totally agree with you. And to add to that, if you look at the region, Iran was the only country for years to support Syria against terrorist groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And even in Iraq, Iran was there to defend Erbil even before the Kurdish region's usual allies in the West. So of course it is a propaganda, and of course Iran is a victim of terrorism. The latest one was the coward act by the U.S. of assassinating General Martyr Qasem Soleimani. So if we look at the record of the countries and not at the propaganda, it is clear which state is committing terror and which state is fighting terror. We were fighting ISIS in Iraq, in Syria, and we were fighting terrorism inside our country for years as well, and still are fighting terrorism. But propaganda machine is getting more and more sophisticated, especially with the advent of social media. And if we use the term coined by French philosopher Baudrillard, the hyper-real or hyper-reality that is created inside this virtual medias and virtual space, sometimes it doesn't refer to the outside reality at all, and it does not need to. So those signifiers don't refer to a signified in the real world. Uh-huh. They are signifiers that refer to the other signifiers, to use the philosophical terms. So it's all in their minds and in the minds of people who are manipulated by these manipulating machines, which are social media, and they have very, very sophisticated algorithms that follow your likes and dislikes and the patterns of your behavior, I mean people's behavior, in order to brainwash them. How much they are successful in that, it needs to be analyzed.
Well, this particular study actually said that some of these, a lot of it, overall, Kevin Barrett, they were not that successful. Actually, they were not able to sway the audience to the intended goals that they had. So why do you think that is? Because that, in a sense, and my question to you is, doesn't that show that the audience out there, the viewers out there, are much smarter now, more informed, especially when it comes to the propaganda leveled against countries like Iran, perhaps, and even Russia and China?
I think that's true. Yes, I think that it's, especially the West Asia region has traditionally been a very difficult audience for Western propaganda. There's this term, the Arab street, that, of course, has been used by the Zionist oligarchs that own Western media and the people in the government, who are really annoyed that ordinary people in the Arab world and the rest of West Asia don't seem to go along with the Western narrative on all sorts of things.
Okay.
And it drives them crazy. And sure. I guess that's continuing now as the social media manipulation is probably cultural factors. It's probably harder for them to figure out what motivates an individual in West Asia than it is for them to figure out what motivates an individual in, say, the United States. They probably just don't have enough sort of science.